He looked exhausted. "He's stable and in recovery," he said. "There wasn't too much organ damage, just an awful 12-inch wound. He's young and strong, and he'll make it." Stone shook his hand. "Thank you, Nils. When can we see him?" "Give him until tomorrow morning," Nils said. "He needs to rest." "Will you ask someone to tell him Kaylee and Stone were here, and we'll be back tomorrow morning?" "Of course." Nils went looking for a nurse. Stone and Marissa dropped Kaylee off at her apartment. "Are you going to be all right?" he asked her. "Sure, now that I know he will be. We'll pick you up at 9 tomorrow morning."
"Make it 10,
Marissa said. "All right, 10. She closed the door to the cab, and they continued downtown to Turtle Bay. "I'm really glad you were there," Stone said.
"So am I,"
Marissa replied. "If it had taken 5 minutes longer to get him a transfusion, he wouldn't have made it." "It's a good thing you requested blood in the ambulance. A 911 ambulance might not have had it aboard." Over dinner, Stone didn't have much to say. Now that Charlie's recovery seemed assured, he started to think about how to proceed without him. "How long will his recovery be?" he asked Marissa.
"Assuming no infection or other complications, he'll be out of the hospital in 4 days or so, and he'll need to recover at home with a daily visit from a nurse to change his dressings for another week. Then he'll be ambulatory. They'll remove the stitches about 2 weeks out. The nurse will know when it's time, and then he'll need some rehab to get his abdominal muscles in shape again. He can work during that time if he feels like it. In a month to 6 weeks, he should have a full recovery."
"Send his medical bills to me," Stone said. "We haven't had time to arrange for company insurance."
"I've already spoken to Dad. The costs are on us, in gratitude for all you did for us during the takeover bid."
"That's very kind of all of you. I know Charlie will be grateful, too." He was already thinking about how to handle the closing with Charlie out of commission.
He and Herbie could get it done, and he had already moved the money and asked the bank for a cashier's check.
The following morning, Charlie looked better than Stone had expected. He had been moved to a lovely private room, which magically had been filled with flowers. His bed had been raised a little to make it easier for him to talk. "How are you feeling?" Stone asked.
"Exhausted."
"You were on the table for 3.5 hours, Stone said. "That's hard work." He told Charlie what Marissa had said about his recovery schedule.
"Charlie, was it Macher or Herman?"
"It wasn't Herman," Charlie said. "Not big enough. It could have been Macher, but there was a handkerchief tied over his face, so I couldn't make him." "Never mind. Can you and Herb close the deal without me?" Charlie asked.
"Sure. Did you think you were indispensable?"
Charlie smiled.
"Well, yeah, sort of. Stone, will you give Kaylee and me a few minutes?"
"Sure. I'll see you tomorrow."
"No, you'll be closing. Just call and let me know how it went."
"Okay. Talk to you then." Stone left. Charlie pressed the button that raised his bed a little more.
"Listen," he said. "I was going to say this yesterday, but I got interrupted."
"Yes, you did, and you scared me to death."
"I'm sorry about that.
What I was going to say to you was, why don't you move into the new apartment with me? Let's live together for a year or so, and if we can still stand each other, let's get married."
Kaylee smiled. "What a good idea."
"Yes, on all points.
Quit your job if you like. You're not going to need the money."
"I like my job, so I'll keep it. Maybe I'll take some time off to get us moved in, so it will be ready when you are.
In the meantime, I'll stay with you in Stone's apartment to see that you're taken care of."
"That would be great," Charlie said. "Now I need to get some sleep. Right after you kiss me."
Kayleigh kissed him, and he closed his eyes. She tiptoed out of the room.
39.
Stone got to his desk on time the next morning and rang for Joan. She picked up the phone.
Yes, boss. Will you please run over to the bank, see Mr. Baird, and pick up a cashier's check for me?
Sure thing. Be right back. She hung up. Stone reviewed his copy of the sales contract and closing statement, and by the time he had finished, Joan was back with the check.
That's a very nice round number, she said, handing him the check.
It's going to buy a dozen or more companies, he replied, for Triangle.
How's Charlie doing?
He was fine when I saw him yesterday. He ran me out and told me to call him today when we've closed.
Good luck,
she said, and went back to her desk. Stone gathered his papers together, put the check in his inside pocket, and got into the Bentley for the trip to the St. Clair mansion. As he walked up the front steps, he was joined by a young man with an elderly yellow Labrador retriever leashed to his wrist.
Yes?
I'm Elliot Crenshaw, the new corporate counsel for St. Clair. We're here for the closing.
Stone scratched the lab behind an ear.
Who's your colleague?
This is Bessie, he said. Sometimes I take her to work. Do you mind?
Not in the least. I've one at home, a lot like her, named Bob.
Then you must be a very happy man. They went into the building and into the library, finding themselves the first there. Crenshaw unleashed Bessie and told her to go lie down. Instead, she began circling the room, sniffing. The three members of the board of directors and Herb Fisher arrived, and Stone shook all their hands.
I'm sorry that Charlie Fox couldn't be with us this morning. He had an accident over the weekend and is spending a few days in the hospital.
Nothing serious, I hope,
Elihu Barnes said.
It was, but he received quick attention and he's recovering normally.
I'm glad to hear it.
They all took seats at the table.
I'll turn this over to Herb Fisher of Woodman and Weld, Stone said.
Bessie began to growl at the fireplace.
Does she detect an intruder?
Stone asked Crenshaw, interrupting Herbie.
Bessie doesn't do intruders, he replied. She spent 8 years at JFK as a sniffer dog.
Drugs?
No, her specialty was bombs.
Stone froze.
Excuse me, gentlemen, he said, but would you all grab your papers and get out of the building as quickly as possible?
What?
Barnes asked.
Get out of the building now,
Stone commanded.
Let's go, gentlemen, Herbie said, and began herding them toward the door. Only Crenshaw stayed.
Stone walked toward the fireplace, surveying the area. Bessie seemed to be concentrating on the wood box. The logs, Stone noted, were stacked neatly beside it, instead of inside it. He reached out for the latch and opened the lid a quarter of an inch, then he looked around the gap for any sign of wires. Nothing. He opened the lid. There was no ticking clock, but there was a cell phone taped to a large brick of what looked like modeling clay.
Elliot, Stone said, take Bessie and go, right now.
Crenshaw hurried for the door, but Bessie had to be dragged. Stone looked at his watch. 12:02. People had arrived a little early. He would normally have called Dino and asked for the bomb squad, but he had the very strong feeling that this phone was going to ring at noon. He ran over to the desk and found a large pair of scissors, then returned to the wood box. He snipped the tape that clamped the phone to the brick, and it came away attached to a single wire, running from the earbud receptacle on the bottom of the phone to a cylinder he believed was a detonator, pushed into the soft material. He unplugged the wire from the phone, and as he did, the instrument lit up and rang. Stone jumped back and dropped the phone, expecting the explosive to detonate. Then the phone rang a second time, and a third. He picked it up and pressed the send button. Hello?
What number is this?
A male voice asked. What number did you call? Stone asked. There was a dead silence at the other end of the phone. Then the man spoke in a half whisper.
Barrington?
Yes, Mr. Marker. Who or what were you expecting, Mr. Boom?
The connection was broken. Stone got out his own phone and pressed the favorites button, then another.
Machete,
Dino said.
It's Stone. Is it important? I'm with some people.
Is one of them a bomb expert? Stone asked.
Funny you should mention that, Dino said.
Stone left the phone and the bomb in the wood box and joined the others on the street.
Mr. Barrington,
Elihu Barnes said,
would you mind explaining what's going on here?
Stone went over and hugged Bessie against his leg.
This young lady, Elliot's Bessie, who is a retired sniffer of bombs at the airport, has just saved all our lives, and probably those of half the neighborhood.
Approaching sirens could be heard. 2 hours later, sitting at a lunch table with the others around the corner from the house, Stone answered his phone.
Stone Barrington?
Mr. Barrington, this is Lieutenant Marconi. Nice job on deactivating your bomb. We've secured it and searched the building for any other explosives. We didn't find anything else, so you can return to the building whenever you wish.
Thank you, Lieutenant, Stone said, and please thank your squad for arriving so quickly and making us feel safe again.
He put the phone away.
Gentlemen, I am informed that the house is now safe, and we may resume our business there.
Everybody got up. Stone paid the bill, and they walked back to the mansion together. 40 minutes later, all I's had been dotted and T's crossed, and a check for $500 million had changed hands.
Congratulations, Mr. Barrington, Barnes said. You and your partners have just become the owners of a fine business.
Thank you,
Stone replied, and began escorting everyone out. Along the way, Barnes leaned over and whispered into Stone's ear,
Was it Marker?
Yes, Stone replied. But it's going to be hard to prove.
40. Stone went straight to the hospital to see Charlie Fox.
When you didn't call, I began to think something had gone wrong, Charlie said.
You could say that, Stone replied.
He related the events of midday.
Marker,
Charlie said.
Of course. Who else?
Can we nail him for it?
I've already talked to Dino, who has talked to the DA. There were no prints on the bomb, and the phone was bought at a convenience store in New Jersey. And I can't swear it was Marker on the phone. It's called insufficient evidence to indict.
I'm glad there's a guard on my room, Charlie said.
There are a dozen strategic services people in the building. You're quite safe.
When I'm out of here, Charlie said, Marker and I are going to have a reckoning.
Don't let that weigh on your mind, Stone replied. You'll internalize your anger and it will affect your recovery.
I feel an intense need to deal with it on a personal level.
I can understand that, but it's not the way to go about it. The DA is still considering whether to charge Marker with the murder of Christian St. Clair, so he's far from out of the woods.
Something else, Charlie said.
What?
He's not going to stop.
Charlie,
no, I'm happy about that.
It will give us other opportunities to kill him legally.
Not while I'm your attorney, Stone said.
Then at some point I'll just have to fire you.
You know who we should talk to about this?
Who?
Ed Rawls. Charlie managed to sit up a little straighter in his bed.
You're damned right, he said.
Ed is smarter than any of us, and he knows more ways to skin a cat than anybody alive. "What can I get you to make your stay more pleasant?" Stone asked. "Magazines? Books? They have a very good library here. A lady comes around every day with a cart full of reading material." "Anything else?"
"A bottle of single malt scotch and a straw."
"All in good time."
"I must be getting better. I'm horny."
"Maybe you should discuss that with Kaylee," Stone said.
"Don't worry, I will." "Oh, I didn't tell you. Kaylee's going to move into the mansion with me."
"Now that's good news."
"She's out shopping now for enough new furniture and stuff so that we can forget Mocker ever lived there. She's going to keep her job at Strategic Services.
By the way, there's a locksmith at the mansion as we speak, rekeying the locks, and Mike's people will change the alarm code. I'll send everything over to Kaylee as soon as the locksmith drops off the new keys."
"I think you'd better call the old employees, the accounting people and the cleaning and cooking staffs, and tell them to come back to work tomorrow."
"All that's in hand. There'll be somebody there to let them in. There's enough cash in the company accounts to pay their salaries and other operating expenses for the moment. I've already sent the bank new signature cards with my and Mike's signatures. We'll add yours later."
"Right.
Stone," Charlie said, "there's something else you can do for me."
"Anything at all?"
"Your pistol and my knife are in my desk drawer in the apartment. Could you get them over to me? I'd be more comfortable with them on hand."
"Did you get your application in for the carry permit?"
"Yes."
"I'll ask Dino if he can rush it, and I'll get the knife to you."
"That'll have to do until you're licensed."
"Oh, all right. I was always better with the knife than the gun when I was in training. By the way, Marissa's father has said that your medical bills and your stay here are on him, so don't worry about that."
"That's very good of him."
"You can thank him when you see him.
In the meantime, I'll have a word with Arthur Steele at the Steele Insurance Group and get a full corporate package put together for Triangle, you, and the new employees."
"You think of everything."
"I'll have to, until you're well enough to think."
Stone said goodbye and went home.
"Get your closing done?" Joan asked.
"By the skin of my teeth," he told her of the day's events.
"Sheesh, that Mocker is a bastard, isn't he?"
"If that's the worst name you can think of."
"Oh, the locksmith dropped off the new keys to the mansion," she said, handing him a set.
"Please messenger a set and the new alarm code to Kaylee Weiss at Strategic Services. Oh, and Charlie has a knife in his desk drawer in the apartment. Include that in the package, but not the gun." She went to get it done, and Stone called Dino.
"Machete."
"Thanks for the help of the NYPD today," Stone said. "They did a great job."
"Don't mention it."
"Charlie Fox has applied for a carry permit, and since he's already been attacked, I can't see any impediment. Can you?"
"Nope. I'll oil the machinery and get it done. Shall I send it to him at the clinic?"
"That will make him feel much better."
"As long as he doesn't hunt Mocker down and shoot him."
"Don't worry. I've already had that conversation with him."
"Bad news," Dino said. "The DA called and says he can't move against Mocker on the murder charge."
"Don't tell me. Not enough evidence."
"You took the words right out of my mouth."
"I'd certainly feel better if he were behind bars, no bail, awaiting trial."
"I'm sorry, I can't provide that service without some paperwork from the DA, and these days I can't send somebody out to hunt him down and kill him."
"You never could do that," Stone said.
"Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could?"
"I always knew you had fascist tendencies."
"Don't tell anybody."
"Dinner later?"
"Sure. Patron?"
"Done."
41. Stone called Ed Rawls, who answered immediately.
"Ed, I need your advice," Stone said. He told him of Macher's effort to blow up the St. Clair building. We don't have enough evidence to prosecute him. Have you any advice as to how to proceed?
Shoot the son of a bitch and don't get caught,
Rawls said. That's excellent advice, Ed, but I need a way ahead that doesn't involve life in prison without parole.
I said don't get caught, didn't I?
Ed, I was a homicide detective for a long time, and I never encountered a perfect murder. These days, there are too many kinds of evidence that didn't exist all those years ago.
Yeah, DNA and all that crap.
Right. How do we defend ourselves from somebody with no scruples at all? Somebody who's willing to do anything?
Stone, Ed said. If I knew that, Marker would already be dead.
Lieutenant George Marconi, who commanded one of the NYPD's bomb squads, sat at his desk and stared at the burner cell phone that had been attached to the bomb found in the St. Clair mansion. He pressed the recent button and found a single phone number. Could this possibly work? He retrieved a small recorder from the desk drawer and plugged it into the cell phone, then pressed send. It was answered on the third ring.
Hello?
Mr. Marker, this is George Marconi. How are you?
Okay, I guess.
Who are you?
I want to be sure that I've got the right person, Marconi said. Is this the Eric Macher who until recently ran the St. Clair Company?
He heard Macher suck in a breath, then stop.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about, Macher said, and hung up.
Marconi sighed. Nearly had him. Macher wouldn't be answering that phone again. He went to his computer and found a secure directory of all cell phone numbers in the Northeast, entered his password, then did a search for Eric Macher. There. He called the number.
Eric Macher, a gruff voice said, the same voice he'd just heard on the burner.
Mr. Macher, it's George Marconi again. Why did you hang up on me?
How'd you get this number? Macher demanded.
Oh, I can get anybody's cell number, Marconi said, even a burner number.
A long silence. Then,
what's a burner number?
That's a number on a throwaway cell phone, like the one you attached to your bomb at the St. Clair Mansion.
Who are you?
I told you, I'm George Marconi.
That doesn't tell me who you are.
I'm curious, Mr. Marker, where did you get the design for your bomb?
Another silence. Then,
bomb? What bomb?
Come on, Eric, you're not going to play dumb, are you? Would you like me to go to the police and tell them you're the guy who planted the bomb at the St. Clair Mansion, and I can prove it?
Prove what?
That you're the man who planted the bomb.
You're insane.
I'm a reasonable man,
Marconi said, trying to get him talking.
I can be bought off, and for less than you might imagine.
Bought off?
Do I have to spell it out for you? Okay, you pay me $25,000, or I'll tip off the police and give them your whereabouts. Is that clear enough for you?
What's clear to me is that you're a crazy person. I don't know anything about any bomb.
He hung up. Marconi's phone rang almost immediately.
Lieutenant Marconi.
Marconi, this is Bichetti.
Afternoon, Commissioner.
What are you turning up on the bomb at the St. Clair Mansion?
Funny you should mention that, sir. I was just on the phone with Eric Macher. I called the phone number that the burner phone attached to the bomb heard from, the one that Mr. Barrington answered.
And who did you get?
Eric Macher, and I recorded the two conversations I had with him.
Play the recordings for me.
Marconi did so.
That was a really good idea,
Dino said,
except for the part about it not working.
It nearly worked, Commissioner.
So it was a really good idea that didn't work.
I guess you could put it that way.
How about coming up with an idea that works?
I'm working on that, Commissioner.
You do that, Lieutenant.
He hung up. Marconi hung up and called his lab.
Yes, Lieutenant?
Have you come up with anything on that explosive I sent you? Funny you should mention that, Lieutenant. I just did. Tell me.
You know, a few years back, there was an experimental program started that was supposed to help us trace explosives.
No, I didn't know that. What kind of program?
The idea was that the manufacturer would place a marker in the explosive that would allow it to be traced back to the manufacturer, who would keep a record of who the explosive was sold to.
Did it work?
Sure, it worked, but Congress wouldn't pass a law allowing that to be done. There was another suggestion that ammunition could be marked the same way. And they were apparently afraid the NRA would shout that they were infringing on gun owners' rights, so they wouldn't approve it for either ammunition or explosives.
So why are you telling me all this?
Because, Lieutenant, the explosive you sent me was apparently part of the experimental program. It contained a tracer element.
So, did you trace it?
Yes, sir. I called the manufacturer, and they were able to look it up and tell me who they sold it to.
Don't keep me in suspense, man. Who did they sell it to?
The CIA.
Marconi's jaw dropped.
You're telling me that the explosive I sent you came from the CIA?
That's what I'm telling you, Lieutenant.
So I called the CIA, and eventually I got connected to somebody in the Technical Services Division who would have issued the explosive to somebody at the agency.
And who did they issue it to?
They wouldn't tell me.
What?
Did you explain that the explosive was part of a criminal investigation?
I did, sir,
but they denied all knowledge of it, so I guess it was kind of a dead end.
Marconi groaned. He thanked the man and hung up. He called the commissioner back, but got his voicemail, so he left a message describing his conversation with the lab.
42. Stone got to Patroon first and ordered drinks for both himself and Dino. They arrived just as Dino did.
"I'm impressed with your timing,"
Dino said.
"You're easily impressed. I just wanted a drink, and I didn't want to wait for you."
"I figured. I just thought I'd make you feel better after what must have been a depressing day."
"Why would you think it was a depressing day? I got the deal closed, and I'm going to make zillions of dollars from it eventually."
"Gee, I don't know. I thought it might have been depressing for you to come within a second of getting your ass scattered all over the Upper East Side."
"On the other hand, it was exhilarating for that to not happen.
You have to look on the bright side, Dino. Otherwise, who would have had a drink waiting for you?"
Dino took a swig.
"You're right. I feel better already."
"I'm so glad.
Listen, I got some interesting news from my people this afternoon."
"I'm always interested in the interesting."
"Turns out the explosive in Marker's bomb was an experimental batch that contained a trace marker that allowed the manufacturer to have a record of who it was delivered to."
"You're right. That is certainly interesting. To whom was it delivered?"
"The CIA."
"Aha!
Don't aha so fast, my friend. They won't tell us who, rather to whom, they issued it."
"Well, that's annoying of them, isn't it?"
"It certainly is, but we have an in with the agency, don't we?"
"And who is that?"
"That is you."
"You think they'd tell me?"
"You're Lance Cabot's fair-haired boy. He'd tell you."
"I question your assessment of the fairness of my hair in Lance's eyes, so let me rephrase the question. You think Lance would tell me, who checked out the explosive, then testify to that in open court? I think he might well express a certain reluctance to participate in that scenario.
You have a point, but you're making it without reference to your gift of persuasion, especially where Lance is concerned.
Oh? Kindly quote me an example of when I persuaded Lance to do something for me. It's always the other way around, and Lance's persuasion is always tainted with a veiled threat about what might befall me if I should not be persuaded.
Okay. You persuaded him to sell you that house in Paris that the agency owned, and at a minimal price, if memory serves.
That was only because Lance desperately wanted something from me.
And what was that something?
I don't recall, offhand, but it must have been something really important to make him that desperate. Also, it was very expensive for the agency to maintain the place as a safe house, and they hardly ever used it. I'm sure the General Services Administration was pleased to have it off their books.
I forget what point I was trying to prove.
You were trying to persuade me that I could persuade Lance to give me the name of the person who signed out the explosive and then to testify to that in open court.
Oh, yes, I remember now.
I'm so relieved. I had thought you were exhibiting signs of early-onset dementia.
Not in the least. Will you call Lance?
Only if we can think of something to give Lance in return, something he really wants. There followed 3 minutes of silent contemplation.
I can't think of a thing,
Dino said finally. Neither can I. Stone got out his cell phone. I'll call Lance.
Good idea. Put it on speaker.
Stone did so. This is Cabot. Why are you calling me at this time of night?
Because I know you work at all hours, Lance.
Ah, Stone. To what do I owe this dubious pleasure? I thought, Lance, that you might derive some satisfaction from helping to imprison a former CIA agent, a thoroughgoing rogue who is a contemptible and murderous swine. As inviting as imprisoning a contemptible and murderous swine sounds, I cannot imagine how I could help. Then I'll clear it up for you. The former agent checked out a quantity of plastic explosive from your technical services division some time back, and after performing whatever task he had in mind, he retained a considerable portion of that explosive until this very morning, when he deployed it in an attempt to murder everyone at a meeting at which I was in attendance, not to mention a few dozen innocents in adjacent buildings on the Upper East Side of this city. We were saved only by a passing Labrador retriever who was skilled in the arts of explosive sniffing.
A passing Labrador retriever? One on the sidewalk, sniffing for a place to do his business, who just happened to zero in on some plastic explosive at your meeting?
It was a she, name of Bessie, but all right, she was actually attending the meeting, in the company of her owner, when she began barking at the fireplace. The bomb was contained in a wood box next to Same, which, at Bessie's suggestion, I opened just in time to disconnect a cell phone attached to said explosive. A moment later, it rang.
I hope you answered it.
I did, and on the other end was the aforesaid contemptible, murderous swine, name of Eric Macher.
Ah, Lance said. I believe I do recall that person, and you have described him accurately.
Thank you.
And what is it you want me to do to him?
Just instruct your Director of Technical Services to testify that the explosive was checked out to Mr. Macher and that he did not return any of it.
Forgive my asking, but how would my man determine that the same explosive he issued to Macher was contained in the bomb of your acquaintance?
Because the manufacturer of said explosive took part in an experimental program to add trace markers to their product, and they have a record of having delivered explosive containing that marker to your own estimable agency, and the NYPD has identified the marker.
All we need is the agency's confirmation that it was issued to Mocker, and none was returned.
Stone, Lance said, I believe you are well acquainted with the level of secrecy under which we operate, are you not?
I am, but I don't see how getting a contemptible, murderous swine off the streets would compromise that secrecy.
Because the world at large is not aware that our technical services division even exists, let alone the name of its director, nor does it know for certain that we sometimes find uses for explosives. We do not wish to implant that information on the consciousness of unsuspecting citizens, which might later emerge to bite us in the ass in a congressional hearing or other such venue, which it surely, as night follows day, would. Please give my warm regards to Bessie, and I bid you a pleasant good evening.
Lance hung up.
You see? Stone asked Dino.
You weren't persuasive enough,
Dino replied.
43. Stone arrived at the Carlson Clinic just before noon and opened the door to Charlie's room to find Charlie and Kaylee close together, both a little breathless and flushed.
I hope I'm not interrupting anything, Stone said, dragging a chair up to Charlie's bedside.
Of course not,
Charlie panted.
I was just leaving,
Kaylee said, checking her appearance in her compact mirror and refreshing her lipstick. She kissed Charlie and left.
You got here just in time, Charlie said. I might have expired.
Lovely way to go, Stone observed.
I'd just as soon hang around for more, Charlie replied.
I thought I'd bring you up to date.
Shoot.
First of all, I checked with Ed Rawls and asked his advice on how best to quietly remove Mocker from the scene.
And what did Ed suggest?
He suggested shooting him in the head and not getting caught.
You know, Charlie said, that's not a bad idea.
I gave Ed the benefit of my experience as a homicide detective in a past life and explained that I had never encountered a perfect murder.
But wait, Charlie said. In a couple of days, I'm going to be ambulatory. I could creep out of here, off Mocker, and creep back in. I'm an invalid. No one would ever suspect me. How perfect is that?
Imperfect, Stone said.
You forget that we have no idea where Mocker is,
or whether he is predisposed to getting shot in the head by an invalid who would probably pop his sutures and bleed to death in the street before he could creep back into the Carlson Clinic.
There is that, Charlie said, looking sad. Then he brightened. I could get Kaylee to shoot him.
She'd like that, and God knows she's been trained for it.
Right, Stone said, brightening too. And she could take the rap for it as well. You and I would go scot-free. I like it.
All right, that was a little unchivalrous of me. It was.
Still, put it out of your mind, Charlie. You know the three most important things about a successful murder, Stone?
Like real estate, location, location, location?
Well, yes, but what were your three things?
I've forgotten.
That may be the best idea of all, Stone said. Just forget it.
There was a knock at the door, and a nurse entered with an envelope.
This was just hand-delivered to you by a policeman, she said, handing it to Charlie.
Charlie opened the envelope and examined the contents.
It's my carry license, he said, beaming.
I spoke to Dino about it.
Stone pulled the little Colt Government 380 he had loaned Charlie from his pocket and handed it to him.
There you are, and all legal.
I feel much better, Charlie said.
And that greatly simplifies our problem, Stone said. All we have to do now is to pull all your guards off, wait for Mocker to come in here to kid you. Then you can shoot him.
Great!
If you don't fall asleep while you're waiting for him to show up, in which case he will kill you.
You're such a killjoy, Charlie said.
Remember,
That thing is loaded, and there's one in the chamber. Is 6 rounds enough to dispatch Mocker when he shows up?
I should think so.
It's a light caliber. Go for a headshot. We don't want him lumbering about the clinic like a wounded bear knocking over things.
I'll keep that in mind, Charlie said.
Okay, I'll get out of here then. I'm having lunch with Marissa at her apartment upstairs.
Don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Or haven't just done. Stone left and took the elevator upstairs to Marissa. She gave him a big kiss.
I haven't seen Charlie today, she said. How is he?
Well enough to accept a little fellatio from Kaylee, Stone replied. I nearly caught them at it.
What a nice idea, Marissa said. Are you up for a little fellatio or cunnilingus? It's a smorgasbord. Take your pick.
Stone grabbed her. A little of everything, please. She fended him off.
It will have to wait until after work. I have an appointment with a patient in 20 minutes.
I'll make it fast. You're forgetting lunch. Your lunch.
Think of me as a canapé at the cocktail hour.
I can't wait around here all day waiting for the cocktail hour.
Let's have lunch, then you go home, and I'll join you at the cocktail hour for a smorgasbord. I'll undress in the cab on the way, so there'll be no waiting.
I like that. I'll try to contain myself until then. They had lunch, and he went home, a tingle with anticipation. Eric Mocker and Jake Herman were having a room service lunch at the Lombardy Hotel.
What went wrong? Jake asked.
I don't know. I rang the cell number and Stone Barrington answered.
He found the bomb?
How'd he do that?
How the hell should I know? Why would he be expecting a bomb?
The guy is supernatural.
No, he's just very lucky, Mocker said.
Same thing. What about Charlie Fox?
He's still in the Carlson Clinic, and there's a heavy strategic services presence there.
What will you do about him?
Wait until he gets out, for a start, Mocker replied.
And then what?
I don't know. Do you have any ideas?
Jake thought about it for a minute.
No.
You're being unhelpful, Jake.
Don't put this off on me. I don't have any reason to kill either Charlie or Barrington.
Have you become uninterested in money?
Jake sighed.
I'll think of something.
44. At the end of Charlie's first week as an invalid, he was examined by his surgeon, Nils Carlson, and discharged as a patient.
Just be careful, Nils said. No abdominal exertion, no running or exercise program. Move about gingerly for another week, then we can start rehab.
Charlie readily agreed, and he was met by Fred in the Bentley outside.
Where's Kaylee? Charlie asked.
Waiting for you at home, Fred replied, and drove away.
Charlie closed his eyes and relaxed, and when Fred opened the door for him, he found himself in front of the St. Clair mansion, and Kaylee was waiting for him on the doorstep. Fred offered his arm, and Charlie climbed the steps one at a time, embraced Kaylee, and then was whisked upstairs in the elevator. The apartment had been transformed from St. Clair's to Kaylee and Charlie's. Several pieces of comfortable but less flamboyant pieces of furniture replaced some of those St. Clair had chosen, and there were flowers everywhere. The beautiful pictures remained where St. Clair had hung them. Kaylee began unbuttoning his shirt.
"Now you should get into bed," she said. "Doctor's orders."
"What else did the doctor order?" Charlie asked, and Kaylee showed him. When he was completely relaxed and she had helped him into a pair of new silk pajamas, she picked up a remote control and made the bed sit up.
"Wow," Charlie said. "Does your side do the same?"
"Yes, it does."
She pressed another button, and a huge TV set rose from the floor before the fireplace. "Now you can watch the game while we wait for lunch to be served by the staff."
"What game?"
"Whatever game." She handed him the remote control. "You choose. It's satellite. There are a zillion channels."
Charlie found a game.
After lunch, Stone called.
"How are you feeling?"
"Never better," Charlie replied honestly.
"Do you think you'd be up for a few days of cruising in autumnal Maine starting Friday?"
"You bet your ass I would."
"Fred will collect you at 9 a.m.
We'll be aboard for lunch."
"I'll be ready."
Kaylee came into the room. "We're cruising aboard our new yacht this weekend," he said. "I know. I've already packed."
"You're not going to need much in the way of clothes," he said.
"The Stones, the Mikes, and the Dinos will be aboard."
"I'm sure they're all broad-minded."
"Maybe, but I'm not. My flesh is for your eyes only. Well, that part of my flesh, anyway."
Maka put down the phone and turned to Jake. "They're going to be aboard my yacht for a long weekend in Maine," he said.
"How do you know that?"
Jake asked. "Intelligence operative aboard."
"Do we know where?"
"They won't be hard to find," Maka said.
He went to a bottom drawer in his bedroom and removed a cardboard box.
"What's in there?" Jake asked.
Mocker opened the box to reveal a block of plastique.
"How much more of that stuff have you got?" Jake asked.
"Enough to do the job," Mocker replied.
"Tell me how you're going to do it.
I seem to recall, Jake, that you own a wetsuit and have considerable experience as a diver."
"True, on both counts."
"That is how," Mocker said. The morning dawned brightly with the hint of a nip in the air. They breakfasted on their terrace overlooking the garden. Then Kaylee put their luggage into the elevator and sent it down. Fred awaited them, and 15 minutes later he pulled the Bentley up to the pad at the east side heliport, where Stone, Marissa, Mike, and his girlfriend awaited. Then he put their luggage aboard. They made themselves comfortable inside the leathered passenger cabin, and the blades began to turn.
"How long to Rockland?" Charlie asked.
"We're not going to Rockland," Stone replied.
An hour and a quarter later, the helicopter, now at low altitude, made a turn, and Charlie saw the yacht cruising slowly into the wind. A moment later, the chopper set down gently on the upper deck, and half a dozen crew members rushed it, emptying the luggage compartment and escorting everyone down the stairs to the main deck. When the copter pad was clear, the machine revved its engines and lifted free of the yacht, turning to the south. Charlie was made comfortable in a soft reclining chair on the after deck, and Kaylee tucked a cashmere blanket around him, while a steward stood by with two drinks on a silver tray. Charlie gratefully sipped his first bourbon in almost a week while the yacht got underway. They lunched on lobster salad, of course, that being the obligatory culinary introduction to Maine. Then the captain came to their table.
"Mr. Barrington, as you suggested, we have waited for the latest forecast before choosing our destination, and we may look forward to sunshine and light winds. Therefore, we have set a course for Martha's Vineyard, and will be at a mooring off the yacht club for dinner."
"Very good, Captain," Stone replied.
He rose and called the man aside. "For this weekend, as I explained on the phone, we require an upgrade in our security."
"I have already personally inspected every corner of the yacht," the captain replied.
"Excellent," Stone replied. "And every night that we are aboard, I want a crew member on the top deck with binoculars, a spotlight, and a rifle. Every morning before sailing, I want a crew member in a wetsuit to inspect the hull,
right down to the keel, for any unwanted attachments.
"Yes, sir," the captain replied.
Stone returned to the table.
"What are you and the captain cooking up?" Marissa asked.
"Just a word about the menus and the wines for our cruise," Stone replied, resuming his seat.
"You were right," Marissa said. "This is a very beautiful yacht, and I'm sorry I called it a stink pot."
"You are forgiven," Stone replied, "and I promise you that when underway, you will be standing vertically and not at an angle to the deck."
"I'm sure I will enjoy that," Marissa replied.
Stone raised his glass. "To the wonderful good taste in yacht building of Christian St. Clair," he toasted.
"Hear, hear," the others replied.
A mile away, Eric Macher, at the helm of a rented 40-foot cabin cruiser, fell in behind them.
"They appear to have set a course for Provincetown, or perhaps the Cape Cod Canal," he said to Jake Herman.
Jake opened another cold beer. 45. They cruised the whole of the afternoon, and as the sun was low in the sky, they picked up a mooring in Edgartown Harbor near the yacht club. The harbor was not as crowded in the early autumn as in midsummer, but there were still many yachts about, and they received the admiring attention of those passing. Mike Freeman handed a triangular flag to a crewman and requested that it be flown at the bow of the yacht.
"What's the flag?" Charlie asked.
"It's the burgee of the New York Yacht Club," Mike replied, "of which I am a member, so we are entitled to fly it. It occurs to me that you and Stone, since you are yachtsmen, should be members as well, and I would be delighted to propose you both."
"I accept," Charlie said, and Stone agreed. They took cocktails on the after deck, then, as the evening grew cooler, moved inside for dinner. Before they entered the saloon, Stone took note that there was a crew member on the upper deck with a pair of binoculars around his neck. After dinner, they adjourned to the saloon and watched a movie on the yacht's video system. Then everyone sleepily headed for their cabins. Marissa marveled at the comforts of the owner's cabin, which Mike and Charlie insisted should always be Stone's.
"It is more comfortable than my bedroom at home," she said, "but not more comfortable than yours." She got into bed and snuggled with Stone. "I'm glad we could make this trip now, because I have to go to Sweden next week to attend to some family business. I'd ask you to come, but you seem to have your hands full here."
"You're right, I'm afraid," Stone said. "How long will you be gone?"
"A week, perhaps two."
"Send me postcards."
"I'll be back before they would be delivered," she said, fondling him. "We must make this weekend memorable, to last us until I'm home again."
Stone found the idea entirely agreeable, as he responded to her touch and returned the favor.
"How far can you swim underwater?" Macher asked.
They were moored at the other end of Edgartown Harbor.
"Not that far," Jake replied. "Not at night, anyway. Besides, there are too many yachts here, even for this time of year. Your object is not to attract attention, isn't it?"
"Hardly," Macher replied.
"We will just enjoy our cruise until the right opportunity presents itself."
The following morning, after breakfast, everyone went into town on foot for some shopping and sightseeing, then stayed ashore for lunch at an Edgartown restaurant.
"The foot traffic here in summer is so thick you can hardly walk down the street," Mike observed. "This time of year is so much better."
Everyone agreed. Macher watched through binoculars as the party was taken ashore in the yacht's tender.
"They're all ashore. I think now would be a good time for you to reconnoiter, Jake." Don't you want to come with me?
No. I might be recognized by one of the crew, and it is not in our interests for them to know I'm around.
What do you want me to reconnoiter? Jake asked.
Just circumnavigate the yacht and look for a likely spot to deposit our payload. The antenna has to be mounted above the waterline.
If you don't mind my saying so, Jake said, I think it would be best to detonate the thing after they've left Edgartown and are not within easy reach of a port.
My guess is they'll head to Nantucket from here, and that's 30 miles of Atlantic Ocean for them to cross, Marker said. And deep water.
Stone had difficulty sleeping that night, which was unusual for him. Around 3 a.m., he disentangled himself from Marissa, put on a cashmere robe and some slippers, and went up to the saloon, where he poured himself a cognac. He strolled out onto the afterdeck and had a look at the lights of the village reflected in the water, and the anchor lights of the neighboring yachts. A large moon was rising. He took a turn around the deck, and when he was coming aft again, noticed the shadow of the yacht cast by the moon. He looked for the shadow of a man on the upper deck, but saw nothing. He walked up the stairs, his slippers soft on the steps, and emerged onto the moon-flooded upper deck. On a sofa on the port side, a human figure was stretched out, snoring softly. Stone walked over and kicked the bottom of the sofa, rousing the crewman.
"What's wrong?" the man asked.
"How can we tell when you are asleep?" Stone asked.
"Well, there was nothing going on."
"And how would you know? Our lives are at risk here, and so is yours. Had that not occurred to you?"
The man got to his feet, and Stone picked up the rifle from the deck and handed it to him.
"Tell you what," he said. "Tomorrow, after sunup, you can volunteer to survey the hull from below."
"Yes, sir," the man said, slinging the rifle onto his shoulder.
Stone went back down to the saloon and refreshed his drink, then sat on the afterdeck, a throw over his lap, watching the moon rise. He didn't have many periods of contemplation in his life. He was too busy. So now he took the opportunity. He thought about what it might be like to be married to Marissa, and the thought was pleasing, though he felt no compulsion to propose such a thing. Maybe after a few months, when the new had worn off. She would probably want children, he mused, though the subject hadn't come up. He wondered how he would handle an infant in the house, and what sort of father he would be. He had missed that part of Peter's life. The boy had been a teenager when they first met. He thought about business.